Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Health Technology Podcast. My name is Christine Minotto. I'm the director of the Roseman Institute at University of California, San Francisco. Our guest today is Alex Stilson. He's currently the CEO and founder of Neptune Medical. Alex is an industry veteran with years of experience in product development and leading a company. Alex is going to tell us about his time at Loma Vista Medical, where he was the founder and CEO. Loma Vista was acquired by C.R. Bart in 2013 for $42 million. It was a 4x exit for the investors. What's particularly interesting is that Alex and Loma Vista had a zigzag path to success. They started out developing an advanced composite material for application in colonoscopy, but pivoted from that to using the material for balloons in kyphoplasty. And then later they pivoted again to using the balloon to support transcatheter aortic valve implantation. Enjoy the talk. Thank you for joining me today. So you founded Loma Vista in 2007 and successfully sold the company to C.R. Bart. Could you tell us about what you were working on at Loma Vista and the challenges that you faced there?
Loma Vista Medical was a lean medical device startup founded in our garage. I founded it in 2006. We pivoted twice, but ultimately the product that we launched was a product that was the number one selling balloon in the world for transcatheter valves. The procedure is known as TAVI, transcatheter aortic valve implantation. Our technology was flexible composites. And so we were really the only dedicated company on the planet that made multiple material, multiple layer balloons. And we focused on this market, a transcatheter valve market. We started in the garage. We grew to a 20-person company. We were funded through a variety of sources, including distributors, angels, and VCs. And we exited to C.R. Bard. We raised $10 million in total, exited to Bard for $41 million about 5 years ago. The product has done very well clinically. The product has about 80% market share. It is really the balloon for transcatheter valves. We were the right technology, the right product at the right time. And I think the product will do roughly $16 million in sales this year.
Loma Vista pivoted twice. So what was the first idea that came out from it?
So we started in the garage and we were going to make a next generation colonoscopy device. And so our background is we went to Stanford. We had done a lot of need finding and determined that colonoscopy was a large market, a growing market, roughly 15 to 20 million procedures a year, and a lot of waste in the procedure. And very classically, if you find waste and then can eliminate waste, you can capture a portion of that value. And so we started in that space, worked on it for about a year and a half, and weren't getting the results that we wanted. And part of the art of being...
Is it more on the clinical side that you're not getting the result you want?
Our clinical results weren't what we wanted. We had a certain test that we did, and we needed to ace those tests, and we were getting good results, but not great results. And we didn't think the results were good enough. And certainly there's an art for an entrepreneur to be persistent, to focus, and to keep on coming back again and again and again. And then there's also an art to knowing when to look to the side and potentially pivot. And so we started the company before Eric Ries's book, The Lean Startup, came out. We prided ourselves on being a lean startup. We had seen a lot of different device companies raise $100 million and then struggle clinically, struggle financially. And so we tried to construct the company in a different way. I think we like to say that we were lean before lean was cool. We went to our VCs and told them this model, and they kind of laughed at us and thought it was cute. They ultimately retracted some of that and said that we like this model. But we started in GI, and we were going down that road and then weren't getting the results we needed, and then started to look around saying, what do we do now? Do we dig in deeper or do we look at something else? And one of the things that we said is that for our technology to work, we were working on certain pneumatic systems. And so we became quite adept at working with different plastics and different materials that are used classically for medical balloons. PBACs, nylon, PET, urethane, silicones. And none of those materials worked very well. And then we started working with a material, a flexible composite material that originally I'd worked with back in 1990 at Stanford when we won the America's Cup vote. And it was a multi-material, multi-layer construct that was used for sailcloth. So we worked with that company and said, we want to sign a deal where we have exclusive worldwide rights to your technology for medical. And their technology worked really, really well. And so we were really excited about that. And that technology ended up being the core of what we pivoted around. And so when we were having trouble in colonoscopy, we said, what are we really good at? And we said, this flexible composite material is a really good material to make better medical balloons. So what if we thought of ourselves not as a colonoscopy company, but as a medical balloon company? And so we did a big market study of different applications for this technology in medical balloons, and we looked at what we were good at and where the market had those needs, and we saw that there are applications initially in kyphoplasty, where people were putting balloons inside the spine. And those balloons needed to have very, very high pressure. They needed to have very, very low stretch. They needed to have good puncture resistance, all properties that were not found typically in existing medical balloon properties, but were found in this flexible composite material. So we eventually convinced our VCs to pivot into the kyphoplasty space. So we were making balloons. We pivoted from being a colonoscopy company to being a balloon company making balloons for spine. And as that relationship developed, there were certain things in Loma Vista that worked out and certain ones that didn't. One of the things that didn't work out was the long-term aspects of that relationship. So it started off, and we were going to outsource all of our manufacture to them. And while the initial nexus of that of their technology was pertinent, there were a lot of things that didn't work that we needed to change, that the only way that we could really solve those problems was to take it in-house. And so they were good at making big sheets. We wanted small products. They were good at flat sheets. We wanted round things. They were good at fibers that were widely distributed. We wanted ours closely placed. They were good at automation over here. We wanted automation that did something else. And so there are a variety of things such that we started out, again, as outsourcing, that we eventually brought it in. One of our stories was that we were very vertically integrated. A lot of medical device companies outsource. We were very vertically integrated, and we woke up one day and said, if we don't solve this problem, we will cease to exist. And so we stopped calling them. We worked out a legal arrangement whereby they owned a certain percentage of the company, and we moved forward knowing that we were responsible for solving that problem, and if we didn't, no one else would.
Even though you own the technology, why did you have to give royalty to the manufacturer?
We had an agreement, okay. And ultimately they spawned certain ideas in our head, and we took those and we ran with them wildly in different directions, but we originally had an agreement, and it was a win-win to settle that and to walk away, and the amount they owned was mutually agreeable. But we woke up knowing that if we didn't solve these problems, we were in trouble. And so we had to convince our VCs, A, to pivot,
right,
which was a big deal. We had to convince them that this contract that was one of the foundations of the company actually wasn't so valuable anyways, and that we were going to create it ourselves. And we had to convince them that we were a manufacturing company. And all three of those were fairly terrifying to them. Typically, VCs don't like spending a lot of money in manufacturing. And we said that this is important. And anyone who understands composites know that composites as structures usually win. The best race cars are composites, the best golf clubs are composites, the best boats are composites, the best airplanes are composites. And our premise was that balloons are structures, and they too should be composite. And so that was a novel concept and required us to really become masters of this and to do so in-house with custom manufacturing. And that took a long time. And so we were doing demos for Kyphon, and they liked what they saw, but they wanted 40 units. And at that time, we could make two.
For the Kyphon company.
For Kyphon. We could make two units to show them, and our yields were 5%. And so it took us 2 years and half of our spend to be able to develop the manufacturing infrastructure to be able to make those in-house. But our premise was that without that manufacturing infrastructure, our costs would be too high and our reliability would be too low. And we were lucky in that our VP of product development, Mark Sheff, was a mechatronics expert, an automation expert. And so we took to it well and created a series of unique manufacturing elements that allowed us to make these balloons much more reliably, much more consistently, much higher performance than anything else out there. And so we essentially created these prototypes. The world said they look good. And then we closed the door and said, we got to figure out how to make these. And raised some money and started working on manufacturing. And then along the way, what happened was every day you exist as a startup, there's you're trying to move the ball forward. There's risks to exogenous events happening and impacting you. In the area of restenosis, I'd like to say the valley had a dozen companies working on restenosis. They were all making good progress. Some were using heat, some were using cold, some were using radiation. They woke up one day and a meteor hit, and that was drug-eluting stents, and boom, wiped them all out. And so every day you're around, you're moving the ball forward, you're advancing, you're making great progress, you're working with your employees, but there's also just the risk of just something happening outside your company. And in this case, it was an article in the New England Journal of Medicine that said kyphoplasty isn't as effective as people thought it was. We think that there are issues with the article, with the study, that there were certain things they overlooked. It wasn't quite fair, but nevertheless, all of a sudden, we had massive headwinds. Mm-hmm. And I'm a cyclist. I've biked around a better part of the world, and I know that there are times where you can look like you're extraordinary, like you're doing extraordinary biking, when in reality is you're doing mediocre biking, but you've got an incredible tailwind. And there are times, conversely, when you look like you're the worst biker in the world, when you're just fighting a 40-mile-an-hour headwind. And so in startup land, startups are ambitious, and startups are ideally funded adequately. But if there are strong headwinds, it's brutal on a startup. It's absolutely brutal. And we woke up and said, this is a major, major headwind that we don't know if we're going to be strong enough to get around. And at about that time, we were lucky. We had a board member, Chuck Love, a good friend, who happened to work for a company called CoreValve. And one of the most successful medical devices over the last 10 years has been transcatheter valves. And Chuck happened to work at CoreValve and knocked on our door and said, CoreValve is doing great work, but they need balloons. And the current balloons they're using are inadequate. Much like kyphoplasty, they have high puncture loads. Much like kyphoplasty, they need very precise dimensions. Much like kyphoplasty, they need very precise shapes. And they need high pressure. And what you're doing for kyphoplasty, just get me one of those balloons, chop it in half, put two of them together, let's do a pig study, and I can show you this is what the world needs. And so
do you think, I mean, that at that point, you have made the decision to left the...
No. So we're working on kyphoplasty, and we're hearing these rumors. We're hearing these rumors from a trusted friend who's a board member that there's this other world out there. And it's difficult for us because we've already pivoted once. I'm pivoting twice.
Right. The investor will be freaking out.
Embarrassed will be. You've told us that this is the best thing in the world, and all of a sudden you're telling us that we shouldn't be doing that, and we should be doing something else. Mm-hmm. So that was difficult for us. Additionally, as well, the TAVI market didn't really exist. In the U.S., there were no commercial TAVI devices. So he wanted us to pivot into a space that had no numbers around it.
Right.
And that was...
So you're doing it parallel.
So we're doing them in parallel. So we're making some prototypes on the side. We went up and did an animal lab. It worked really well.
Do you tell the board member that you're getting this side job?
We kind of have one slide in the board deck that says, oh, by the way, here's a prototype that we made that's intriguing.
And did they...
They didn't really know what to make of it at first. luckily, we were small enough that we weren't number one on their radar. They had companies that were funded to the tune of $100 million. They had companies that IPO'd. And so we were small enough that we could kind of get away with some of these experiments without getting a lot of the attention. At first, they didn't quite know what to make of it. And then finally, we had what we referred to as a bake-off. We were lucky in that the biggest conference in the U.S. for spine and the biggest conference for interventional cardiology were both in San Francisco about a month apart. And so a lot of lean startup methodology is you have your business plan, you have your hypothesis, you have your thesis, but at the end of the day, you're running experiments and you're collecting data. And I think that's been a big change in the world for startups in the last 10 years, that people realize that you're running a series of experiments. And how efficiently can you create experiments and run experiments, collect data, and then reinvigorate your assumptions and your plans going forward. And so we were going to run an experiment. An experiment was we presented both conferences, we present to the corporates, we wear our nicest suits, we get a nice suite, we do demos for both, and we see how much love we get. And we walked away and we said, kyphoplasty's in trouble. And that was prescient. Kyphon had been purchased by Medtronic, went from being a very entrepreneurial company to a less entrepreneurial subdivision of a large cap. Their market, their sales have since, I think, dropped by two-thirds. They've gone from roughly $750 million to $250 million. And so, it proved to be the right decision. And then TAVR has taken off, and Edwards has done incredible things in this space. CoreValve has been successful to a certain degree as well. And so we hitched our train to TAVI, and we got back, and we were a small enough company, and we said, we are now a TAVI company.
And what do you do to tell the board? It's like,
We told the board that we're a TAVI company.
And they were like, okay, the third time is the charm.
And they were, you know, a little bit concerned, a little bit skeptical, and rightly so. But we said, that, you know, here's the data, here's the experiment we ran, and this is why we think this is the case. And we thought that there was enough data there, and there was appropriate experiments such that we thought this made sense.
So at that point, probably you didn't ask for additional funding. Maybe that's why they are...
It was important to not pivot at the same time that you're raising money. you want to be able to separate those two by a certain amount of time. We pivoted. And in retrospect, pivoting is much more common than people realize. There are a lot of companies that have followed a certain path that arguably, if they pivoted, that they would have survived in different forms. Pivoting is very common in the venture world and startup world. There are an enormous number of startups we can cite who have successfully pivoted. But at the time, it was a big deal, and it's not as common in medical. We like to quote Intuitive Surgical. Intuitive Surgical started out very, very clearly, and they were in cardiology. And they IPO'd, and they had 16 different applications for their product. This was their chance to show the world all that it could be used for, and urology was not one of those mentioned. And they pivoted. They didn't have to change their technology much, but they pivoted their clinical application. And it was the key for them going from a startup that had IPO'd at 8 or 9 and has gotten as low as 3 and was really a deeply, deeply flawed, struggling company to one that has gone on to be one of the great companies in the space, one of the arguably the most successful medical device startup out of Silicon Valley, now worth $60 billion. Again, was that pivot from 3 years in cardiology to the clinical application of urology, where they've dominated and then really use that as a platform to other clinical applications. So this is more common than people realize, but it's certainly unnerving at the time. It helps if you're lean. It helps if you don't have a sales force yet. If you have 10 people who are experts in kyphoplasty and all of a sudden you're...
You still use the same people.
We didn't have to lay anyone off. Right. There were certainly assets that got redeployed. But there were also assets that got thrown away. There were surgical instruments that were used for kyphoplasty that got thrown away. There was knowledge in the spinal space that got thrown away, but a large amount of it did get transferred over. And that core that we pivoted around was flexible composites and then automated flexible composite manufacturing for disposable devices. And that core was sufficient and was what we wrote into TAVI.
I mean, one thing, you have to convince your investors and the board, but also the people who are working in a project for years.
Yes.
And instead of like, God, this guy keeps changing his mind.
Yes. Yes. Every time you do this, a certain amount of trust gets reduced. A certain amount of confidence in the company gets reduced. And you hope that there is enough there in the first place that things go forward. And you hope that the data you presented makes sense. And you hope that the workplace is a positive and unique enough place that people want to continue anyways. But it is not a foregone conclusion that you pivot and don't lose a lot of investors or employees.
And did you guys end up losing anybody?
We didn't lose anyone. We didn't lose anyone. Yeah. So we went we woke up and said, we are a TAVR company. And we were very fortunate. Our board was very valuable. And Chuck Love, who worked in the space, knew distributors, who were the number one selling distributors for the CoreValve product. And so we brought them on board as investors. We pitched to them, and they liked us. And the key there was that having distributors as investors really helped validate our story. The VCs were a little bit unsure about the TAVI market because it didn't really exist yet, but they could talk to the world's number one selling TAVI distributors. And if they invested, that was a huge vote of confidence. And then very importantly as well, a lot of companies, once they get once they get clearance, they launch and there's a big gap in the company where they're lining up salespeople and where they're trying to gain market knowledge. And the whole ramping process is very slow and painful and laborious. In this case, once we had clearance, we'd call up our distributor in Germany and say, meet me in Frankfurt next week. And we took a plane to Frankfurt, and we had CE mark, and he said, we'll drive around. We know the top 200 TAVR docs in Germany. We'll go visit them. And we went around, and every day we'd visit 2 or 3 more, and it was a great way to ramp things up very quickly and methodically with some very wise help.
It's interesting because you keep going back to Chuck Luft, the connection, and when you started Loma Vista in the space of colonoscopy, why Chuck Luft in DeBoard?
Chuck was someone I knew and trusted, he was a medical device, a serial entrepreneur. Typically in medical devices, the people I know don't restrict themselves to one clinical area. There's enough going on in the world, enough opportunities that they move often fairly fluidly between cardiology and spine or ENT or in our case GI. And so we viewed him as a sage medical device entrepreneur.
It
was good to have on the board. And he was very helpful. We had great board members. The board was an important part of our success. We had Joe Mandato at DeNovo. And Joe was an early believer in the company. He believed in us before there was arguably as much there as other VCs saw. And that was important. They funded us through each subsequent round. Jay Watkins was a key part of our acquisition. Jay is the best strategic thinker I know in the space, and he was able to work with Bard and get a deal done when it could have easily failed to happen. Our fourth board member was out of SHD, Carter Meyer from out of Texas, and he was a very steady hand. He was very helpful at multiple points in the company, without which we probably would have died. Startups are half the time you feel very strong and you're changing the world and you're doing amazing things, and half the time you're on the edge of death. And the board members definitely helped us survive and thrive in a very dynamic situation.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com. So you drove around in Germany to have your product tested, and then what happened next?
At that point, we were scaling manufacturing. We were trying to expand in different geographies. We were also working on next-generation product. Our balloon and ended up being the best in its class, but by far. Importantly, one of the layers that we bring to the product development process, Stanford product development process, talks about design thinking, it talks about need finding. I think we add another layer of understanding corporates and the way they operate, and that helps set up certain screens as to what we like to do and how we like to do them. I think we understood that what battles we were getting into. For example, when we were going against Kyphon was a company worth $3 or $4 billion, but they only had one or two people working on their balloons. And so we were able to understand that intelligence, that market intelligence, and go into a space with a certain amount of confidence that people would say, wow, how are you going to compete with this $4 billion company? And part of it was that they, for certain reasons, had neglected this key element. Similarly, in TAVI, these were companies. Edwards has gone on to be an incredible company, very, very focused, very entrepreneurial, very dynamic. But they were very focused on the valve, and they weren't focused on the accessories. And so we were able to get the intel that this was an area, despite the fact that there was all this money and all these companies and fighting against Medtronic, that it was actually neglected. And that a small group of people in a small building out in California could compete very, very effectively because we actually had, not only were we working harder, not only did we had a novel approach, not only think we were further ahead, but we actually had more mass than they did in this area. And so we saw that we were scaling our manufacturing, we were proceeding with confidence relative to the competitors out there, and we were working on next-gen products. We had a product that uniquely allowed the ability to dilate the aortic annulus while blood went through the center. And so during this procedure, and when you inflate a balloon in the annulus, you're doing so for several reasons. One of them is that you're trying to prep the annulus for a valve. It's a calcified annulus. And often if they deploy a valve, the valve fights the calcific stenosis to a degree that it can't fully open. And if the valve can't fully open, the flow dynamics are going to be awful. It's a real problem. And so we would pre-dilate really well. Often we would post-dilate well. And as you're doing so, you're blocking the outflow of the heart. This is 100% of the outflow of the heart. And so there have been balloons that have been used in the coronaries, which are much smaller, that block 100% of flow. But in that case, they're 3 millimeters in diameter, and there's collateral flow, and it's not a big deal. But blocking the aortic annulus is a big deal. There's a very significant pressure. It's a very significant area. And the whole rest of the body is essentially ischemic. And so we did it better than anyone else, but certainly an unmet need was the ability to dilate reliably, consistently, in a dimensionally correct way without puncture, and being able to hold that. And no one had ever been able to do that before. And so we worked on a follow-on product called the TrueFlow that was led by a young engineer named Garrett Gomes, who carried it across the finish line after the Bard acquisition, that allowed us to do this. And that is really a seminal product in the field, and that it, again, allows you to dilate very, very quickly, very, very precisely without risk of puncture, and allows flow to go through the center. So you can inflate for 5 or 10 minutes.
So the complete development is done when you guys are under Bard.
So the complete development was. And so my point was, one of the challenges was feeding the current product and working on next-gen products. And that was a remarkably difficult challenge. We thought that once we launched, we would kind of be manufacturing the first product, which is the True, and then we'd be able to work on next gen products. But once you launch, if there are any problems out in the field, that's what gets responded to. I mean, they want different sizes, they want different flavors, they want manufacturing cost reductions, they want manufacturing volume ramp up. And that all took a fair amount of time. And so we didn't have the energy that we really needed to work on next generation product. And it's one of the things that we're trying to do better here at my new company, Neptune Medical, is both have the main product that's got to get out the door, it's got to sell, it's got to be best in class, but also still be able to innovate on next gen products, because that's what a startup exists to do. Is bring new, exciting products to the world that are risky and bold, that a large cap wouldn't take the bets on. And so we're trying to do those in parallel better here than we did there. I said we were able to get prototypes out before that proved the concept, but getting it across the line was an ongoing challenge as we had launched. And then once we had launched, working hard on our IP, and we get a call. It was December of 2012, I believe. And there was a call from Bard. And Bard called one of our board members, Jay Watkins. And the call said, "Hey, we're just walking down the hall here at Bard, you know, and walking past the legal department. And as you know, it's a long walk because we spend a lot on IP and a lot on our legal department." Uh-huh. And one of the things they've told me is that there's this company out in California, Loma Mountain Company, and they're making a balloon that violates our IP. And as you know, we take our IP very seriously. And they tell me that we should sue you into the ground, but I want to work with you. So what do you say? Are we going to work together, or are we going to fight this out? And so that was the opening call.
That's an interesting call.
That was the opening call. And I was terrified. Jay said, "No, this is good. This is good. They care about us. We're on their radar, and we're engaged."
So if somebody called me, they're going to sue me, I should be very happy.
It shows they care about you. It shows they care about you and they're interested. And deep down, they probably have more insecurities than they let on about. And indeed, they had a platform that was powerful and successful, but at the same time, it was aging. At the same time, their manufacturing was very old school. I mean, it was very manual, whereas ours was automated. At the same time, they wanted to get into transcatheter valves. And so we were a good way to solve multiple problems for them. Interestingly enough, they had IP that was fairly old, a lot of applications that had been floating around, I think in some cases, some for up to a decade. And so they accused us of violating their IP, and we said very clearly, "We know your IP better than anyone else, and you're wrong, we don't." Turned out that was only partially true. We knew their IP as it existed.
They're calling you the bluff, or you're calling them the bluff?
Well, so we just turned out to be ignorant. we were very aware of their IP as it had existed in November. But since we had last reviewed it in the previous month, they had multiple patents granted that we weren't aware of, with very broad claims. Okay. And so we very confidently stated something that turned out to be old news rather than the updated news. And so that started a 6-month process of them trying to dance with us trying to dance with them, At the same time as that there were threats, and at the same time that we realized at a certain point some of these threats were very real. And so we, with that gun to our head, eventually created some of the best IP that we had. And so people, I think a lot of companies are founded upon a key amount of key IP that the company is, key IP that spawns the company. In this case, we found that our best ideas came in year 7. And so we'd been working on this for a long time, but it was really the end result of this gun to our head from Bard and a deep understanding of manufacturing, a deep understanding of all the different ways that things wouldn't work, and then combining multiple elements together that allowed us really in year 7 to come up with our best IP. And our best IP, we were able to throw on the table to them right before one of their tours and said, this gets around your patent. It doesn't just get around it. It's better. It's a better way to make the balloon. You throw in the manufacturing, and we're free to run. And if you want to sue us, we'll just move on up to Vancouver. We've got a head of manufacturing whose wife teaches English as a second language. There are plenty of people to teach up there. It's a very international city. It's a wonderful city. I've been there multiple times. It's a beautiful city. And we could set up in 1,000 square feet a facility that would make the world's supply of these balloons, and at the least, to save money, we wouldn't fight you in the U.S., but we would sell to there are 178 other countries in the world, 183, so we'd sell to all of those except for the U.S., and every day we'd be getting stronger and better, and you would have chased us out of the U.S., but every day there's a risk that we sign with one of your partners and continue to move past you, and so that ultimately it was a combination of bluff and reality, and we sat down and said, let's make this work, and Jay worked tirelessly to put a deal together that ended up being a real win-win. It was good for our shareholders. It was good for Bard, and Bard has built a great franchise around it. It's allowed them to improve their manufacturing to an enormous degree. It's allowed them to enter the TAVR space. It's allowed them to reinvigorate their flexible composite balloon franchise. And to stave off further attacks from potential competitors.
In a way, they kind of help you. They push you in a corner, you just like punch back.
It was a stressful time. It was a stressful time. But it was the right thing to do. In retrospect, it's a question at any startup. You take one in the hand or two in the bush. I think if we would have remained an independent company, we could have done a lot more. We could have grown, our sales would have gone up by at least an order of magnitude. We could have entered new opportunities in ENT. We could have had new opportunities in spine, in peripheral vascular. But at the same time, we've been running hard and fast. And startups are aggressive beasts that are inherently unsustainable. And we thought that this was enough and that this was a good point. And so we sold with about 80% up front and then certain milestones and ultimately hit all those milestones and got all the escrows as well. And
And then
some of the employees stayed on and then I worked with Bard through the transition.
Okay. And so, I mean, this is a good segue to talk about your new adventure. So can you tell us more?
So after Loma Vista, I worked as a consultant for Bard for a short period of time. Took some time helping a few other entrepreneurs start an organization called the Silicon Valley Lean Medical Device Council that did well for its 2 or 3 years of existence and did some traveled with the family around the world, and then also sat down and said, what were some of the lessons from Loma Vista? I'm a firm believer you wake up every day and work hard and make progress, but then pause periodically and say, what did we learn from that? We ran a series of experiments. What worked? What didn't? What did we learn? What do we want to do more of? What do we want to do less of? What do we want to stay away from? What pattern matching can we see here that you make progress? And so I sat down, came up with about 300 different slides of what we learned, what worked, what didn't, and then said, what do I want to do? And decided I want to be back in the mix as an entrepreneur in medical devices. I like medical. I think there's a lot of work yet to be done. I think that it's a field that matters. I think it's a good match to who I am. The venture model has its flaws, but it's a successful and important model for change in the world. And currently, all five of America's most valuable companies are all venture funded initially. So it's a powerful model, and being able to work with that, but also in some modified way that is more potentially a better fit for a lean medical device startup let's do this. And so we started in the garage again, remodeled the garage, but nevertheless in the garage.
A garage probably by now.
it's a nice garage. It's a great startup garage. And started in the garage and working in GI. And think that GI.
We're back to the GI.
So there's a certain amount of unfinished business there and a certain amount of things that we thought were worth working on. And worked on products there for a certain period of time. Brought in an employee, Garrett, who had worked very well at Loma Vista. Got him out of his contract with Bard. I've been able to allow that to happen. That was a big deal. And Garrett and I worked together on a certain product. And then, in fairly typical fashion, as we're working on that product, saw a sub need that we worked to solve that is now a standalone product. And so the
don't tell me you pivot already.
So we pivoted already. So depending how you count it, we have either three products that we have proudly worked on. We spend 98% of our time at the moment on one of them, but we have been three different products that we have worked on, and we believe our current product has broad applicability across GI. We believe, from a corporate standpoint, that there's not a lot of other people in the world working on this. We believe it's got an initial beachhead that is compelling, but then the ability to run deeply beyond that. We believe our IP is unique, and it solves very important clinical problems. So we're working on that. We're now a 5-person company, soon to be an 8-person company. We closed our Series A just last month. We moved out of the garage last month. The garage has its charms, but we'd earned the certain stage of growth to move out, and are working. Board with Neptune Medical.
So where do you get these ideas for Neptune Medical? Is this something that you learned while you're in hibernation between Loma Vista?
We started off with a product that we thought was a good fit to our skills, that it was a very clear unmet need. There are clinicians we worked with. There were journal articles that we read. There were VCs that we talked to. All of them said, this is a very clear unmet need. And we knew if no one actively working to solve the problem. So we liked that as well. We thought it was a good fit and a clear unmet need. That was originally navigating through the small intestine. So in the company's Neptune Medical, with the premise that we've sent probes beyond the farthest planet in the solar system, which is Neptune, we've sent probes that have now left the solar system. We ought to be able to send probes through the GI tract, and we currently can't. We currently can't send probes all the way through the GI tract. We can do colonoscopy, roughly 15 to 20 million times a year in the U.S. We can do upper endoscopy really well, but there's no system in the world right now that can reliably get all the way through the small intestine. There's the PillCam, which is great, but the PillCam doesn't insufflate, the PillCam doesn't have directional control, and the PillCam can't treat. And then there's the Fuji double balloon system, which is a pioneering system. It really hasn't been improved much in 15 years and doesn't allow a clinician to get through reliably. We've talked to clinicians that have done 500 cases and never been through once before. And so we saw this as a clear unmet need working in that, and then saw some sub problems along the way that were impeding our progress that again have become now standalone problems that we are focused on.
So you're working on two different problems right now?
We've had three different products we're working on at one point. And it's an ongoing challenge to staff multiple projects.
With five people that you have.
Yeah, so startups win through focus and dedication. And it's difficult to be saying this is the most important product and saying that twice in parallel at the same time with resource constraints. So we've tried to parallel path things, and we parallel path them to a certain degree, but at the moment we are 98% focused on this one product, and the other two are on the back burner, and we hope that we have the durability and ultimately the resources to come back to them, because we think that they are critical problems. We hope that the company is set up to be able to run potentially a little bit longer than last time. We're trying to both be aggressive and to work hard and to work fast, to be dedicated, but also set ourselves up that we can run potentially longer and further and accomplish not only what's directly in front of us, but also a lot of these peripheral challenges that we think that are ultimately potentially bigger.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com. You like being in a medical space. What did you work on before Loma Vista? Have you always been in the medical world?
Yes, I spent the majority of my time at Stanford designing, building, and racing solar-powered vehicles. I did that for 4 years. I did it for a year after graduation. I lived on a friend's floor, a friend being Mark, who's our VP of product development. So we've been friends now for 30 years. And so projects from entirely from start to finish, very ambitious designs, resource constraints, very clear win-or-lose criteria. And that was a big eye-opener for me and a big training ground for who I was and who I developed into as an engineer and entrepreneur. And then from there, first job out of school, worked for a company called Edge Innovations, which was a pioneering company in Palo Alto that was doing the world's best animatronic special effects for the film industry. And had a lot of very good friends there. We did the best, we did robotic whales for Free Willy. Oh. Did a robotic whales movie.
That whale is not real.
There are certain scenes in it that are digitally enhanced. There are certain ones that are stock footage of whales, but the majority of the scenes are with our robotic whales. And so these were very, very innovative, hardcore aerospace grade robotics projects, start to finish in very short periods of time. $8 million worth of robots, and we would make robotic blowhole, robotic eyes, robotic tongue. It would swim under its own power by flipping its by kicking its tail. Its pecs would move. So we had beautiful, beautiful creatures, incredible machines. And then we did the snakes for Anaconda. So very ambitious projects, but ultimately.
Blockbuster movie, though.
Free Willy was a big success. Anaconda has done well in video.
Okay. I heard the name.
It's a beautiful snake. John Voight was in the movie. Jennifer Lopez. Ice Cube was in the movie. So it was an interesting movie. And the firm has gone on to do a wide variety of special effects, typically around aquatic marine mammals. Did that for a certain period of time. Loved the people there. Loved the ability to pursue things to the nth degree in a very short period of time. Took 6 months off. Biked around Asia. Biked from Turkey to Mongolia with some friends. Came back and wanted to do something in a field that I thought mattered more. And was lucky in that right down the street, Tarabella Street, Mountain View, there was a firm doing robotics for medical. This was Intuitive Surgical. And so shortened my commute by a few hundred yards, worked for one of my mentors there, and worked in medical robotics, which really interested me. I thought it was a good fit, the ability to create companies of significant value using skills that I thought either I could have or could build or could put together, doing things that really mattered. And from there, worked there for 6 months and then went to business school. Came back and said, I want to be back in medical. And so have been in medical ever since. Have gravitated towards the startup scene. Startups are a better fit for who I am than large companies for certain reasons. And have been in medical device startups all but 18 months out of the last 20 years. I'm happy there. And I'm very...
So when you finished business school, you came back to the Silicon Valley.
Yes.
And then you worked for another company before you start your Loma Vista, or that was when you decided, I now have equipped myself with everything I need?
No, I definitely didn't. Coming out of business school, I said, I have a lot to learn, and I went to Guidant. I thought I would learn from an industry leader. Guidant was, at the time, doing very well in stents. They were an interesting place to learn. I worked there 18 months. Ultimately, wasn't a good fit for who I am as an individual, but learned a lot. I think it allowed me to better understand how to compete with large companies. I think people look at them from the outside and view them as these behemoths that are impenetrable and with enormous resources. But I think I quickly understood that they do certain things well, but there are other things they don't do well. And understanding how to compete with them then has been an important learning from that time there. I think that they fight very hard to maintain certain franchises, but really neglect a lot along the periphery. I think that they tend to reward political mavens more than they reward innovators. I think that they are a poor fit for people who really want to do some of the things that I want to do. And so they do certain things well, but understanding what they don't do well, I think has helped us in our entrepreneurial success. And so I went from there to a company called Converge Medical, a company that was ultimately not successful, but doing nitinol implants for bypass surgery, doing flow optimized anastomoses. The company raised close to $40 million. Interesting product, beautiful product, some key early results, but ultimately didn't have enough to make it. And then from there, I went to InSound Medical, an extended wear hearing aid, and I was the sixth head of product development there. The product has been successful. The product, the company was able to sell itself, and it's been a very successful. The product is called the Lyric. It's been very successful work there, and ultimately several things happened. I believe you should stay in an environment when there's people you believe in, when there's a product you believe in, when you're paid fairly, and when there's clearly a differential in learning and in knowledge. And every day, if you can wake up and there's a gradient, and the gradient flows to you, and you say, "I'm learning from these people, and I'm making progress." When you wake up and you say, "I've heard all their stories, I know what they're going to do," and the gradient is smaller, or flat, or negative, it's time to move on. And that was the case. That the gradient was very, very flat. I was also fired, so that made it easy. I essentially was at the wrong end of a political dispute, and was fired. So I came home early one day, and my wife said, "Oh, you're sure home early today." And, and she hugged me and said, "This will be for the better. You'll go off and do great things. And this kick in the pants is what you needed." And right.
Doing what you wanted to do.
And so it was a kick in the pants, and this is what I wanted to do. I'm lucky I have a lot of role models. My dad's an entrepreneur. My cousin's an entrepreneur. I have, my outlook, probably 80 friends who are founder and CEOs. The Stanford connection, the business school connection, all of these things. This is the peer group. This is what people in our space do. It was time.
Yeah.
It was time, and it was the right kick in the pants at the right time. And that's what started Loma Vista.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I think sometimes when the world gives you lemon, you make lemonade.
Yes.
And actually turn out to be the best lemonade.
Yes.
So I want to ask you a bit. I mean, I mentioned about you. I mean, you mentioned about you're taking the bike, traveling throughout Asia, and I thought that was really brave. So you have that sense of adventurous. I don't think I would ever do that. But tell me more about that. It's a pretty long route and not safe. Probably.
I think it's safer than people realize. When I was 16, I'd biked across the U.S., and that was a big eye-opener for me, a big adventure at a young age. I decided I really liked endurance sports. I liked travel. I liked the intense bonding that came from traveling in this tribe with people across a landmass. Did it again in 87. In 88, biked across Canada with some friends, and then in 92, right after graduating from college, came up with the idea of biking not the continent, west to east, but going north and south. And so I don't know of anyone who had done that before, but I was inspired by a friend who had done some hiking in Alaska, had read a lot of books by an author named Farley Mowat about the north. And we decided to bike from Oregon to the Arctic Ocean and then back to Palo Alto. And that was
How long does it take?
That's 6,500 miles. And so it's a long way. It's essentially equivalent to biking across the U.S. twice. And got together seven friends. There were seven of us total. Three of us had 10 tours under our belt, and then four rookies. And
they all stay.
They all stayed. We're all good friends. We get together every year. We just had a reunion last weekend, our 26-year reunion, and we're all still very close friends. And so we biked, averaged 100 miles a day, fully self-contained, and biked all the way to the Arctic Ocean, which is magical in the summer. Tough to be there in January, but the Arctic Ocean in the summer is magnificent. And then biked all the way back to Palo Alto, and loved that at multiple levels. And said, "What's the best bike tour that the planet has to offer?" And looked around, came up with different ideas, and ultimately decided on a 6-month tour from Istanbul to Mongolia, and going from across Turkey, across the Black Sea, go to the Ukraine, Russia, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, across Soviet Central Asia, into China, in the extreme western corner on the Karakoram Highway, through Pakistan, into India, through Nepal, up through Tibet, into Lhasa, north off the plateau into Golmud, and then from there across the Gobi Desert into Mongolia, and then taking the Trans-Siberian back. So did that. In that case, there was more attrition. Started with six, finished with two.
Okay.
You're fantastic
one of the
trip. I was one of the two. Fantastic trip. I don't view it as unsafe in any way. I think the rest of the world is a lot safer than people give it credit for being. When you arrive on a bike, there's immediate trust that develops. People respect you. They are obviously hardworking. You're obviously interested in who they are and their country, or you wouldn't be there. And so never had any safety issues. The biggest risk is probably just getting hit by a car. But luckily, there are a lot fewer cars on the road there, and no one's in much of a hurry, and a lot of the cars don't go very fast anyway. So I enjoyed that. Those were some of my best days. And then came back the year after and biked the Caucasus, Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan, which I loved. And then I took some time off between work and business school and family and startups. I took some time off, but then after Loma Vista sold, toured Cuba, which was wonderful. A fascinating place. And then went back with the family a year after that. Didn't bike, but toured North Korea with a group. Yeah. And North Korea is a fascinating place.
They don't like you bike around?
It's impossible. Absolutely impossible. You can't stray more than a few yards from your minder. It's a very, very, very tightly controlled country. But certainly, I wouldn't want to live there. And it's a failed country in many regards. But there's still an enormous amount to learn from it. And it's a fascinating place, unlike any other. And we were lucky to go there on a tour for a week and a half before it closed. Now, under the Trump administration, you can't go there anymore. So I'm lucky to have some good travels.
So what's next? I mean,
for the moment, it's focused on the startup. When people fund you, then they want to know that you're focused on your work. And so I have some ideas for some trips after Neptune. But for the moment, it's when people write a check, we go in the office and we focus.
That's
and we're trying to launch our product next year. And we're trying to get in people. We're trying to work on some corporate relationships. We're trying to work on the ability to expand this technology from accessories into complete systems. And we're trying to be the best company in the world at what we do.
Right.
And developing an expansive senses to what we do.
Well, I'm looking forward to see what's the outcome of the Neptune. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Christine.